Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of Not Another Podcast Presents Castlevania. Now, I'm Andy Goddard and joining me today is not Jonathan Keane because he's probably drunk in some bar somewhere. So I am joined by Matthew Lamborn from the RGDS Podcast. How you doing, buddy?
All right, Andy. Thanks for having me on the show. And for the record, I was drunk in a bar last night. So, I mean, John taking it in turns to terrorise the neighbourhood.
That's all right, matey. Now, okay, now I've recorded with you previously. For any of our listeners who aren't aware of you, you record for the RGDS podcast. This is where we recorded. But you also record for a few other podcasts, don't you?
Just one other at the moment. I'm occasionally on the Fail Critics podcast, which is a movie review site. And given that we're discussing Castlevania tonight on Not Another Podcast, I actually did an article about this Castlevania series for the Fail Critics website, which you can find at failcritics.com if you're interested in finding out more about that. But much happier to be talking about it with yourself, who's a massive Castlevania fan, than jotting ideas down on paper, so this should be fun.
Right, so I don't actually think myself and you, Matthew, have actually spoken about Castlevania games, really. I think we've briefly discussed it, but not in detail. What's your history with Castlevania? Because we will talk about the TV series in a bit, but I just want people to get like a little bit of feedback on you and Castlevania.
Yeah, sure. So my experience with the series started way back on the original NES. I know most people who find themselves as retro gamers these days perhaps started their gaming careers, as far as 8-bit consoles are concerned, perhaps with a Master System, but I was the odd one out, although my brother owned a Master System and I grew up with that. My first personal console was an NES, so Castlevania was one of those standout games that you had to get. Didn't have much experience with Castlevania 2 or 3 until later on, so I've gone back to that retrospectively. But I was very much there when Super Castlevania 4 came out, and then sort of tailed off my interest, at least as the games were being released. I didn't get to play Bloodlines on the Mega Drive when it came out, because I'd sort of moved on from there, and didn't have a PC Engine during those times, so I didn't get to experience Rondo of Blood, but then came back to the series when Symphony of the Night came out. So that's kind of how it's gone for me, and I've explored more of them as I've gotten back into retro gaming in the last few years. But in terms of what I played at the time, sort of got up to Symphony of the Night and sort of swerved away from the series after that.
Oh, I've said to John this many, many a times, you have to play Aria of Sorrow, you have to play Dawn of Sorrow. Those games are amazing. And the ones on the 360, like, was it Lord of Shadows? Isn't too bad, but doesn't quite feel like a Castlevania game as the others, though.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. I have a good idea that I would get on with, like, the Game Boy Advance games and the like, the ones that you mentioned, Aria of Sorrow and whatnot. I don't particularly like the look of where things were going with the 3D based games on N64 and PS2 and that. I think Castlevania, classically speaking, is and should be a 2D game.
Yeah.
And that's how it sort of works best. It doesn't seem quite right in 3D to me. It hasn't been able to evolve from 2D into 3D like a lot of other classic series have done. But quite prepared to eat my words and give them all a try, because I do love the series in general, but I think 2D is where Castlevania is at its best.
Now, I'm not sure if you're aware, though, but, you know, the Netflix TV series Castlevania is loosely based on Castlevania 3 on the NES, Dracula's Curse. I only found out recently. Well, I'm really amazed. I'm not sure how closely it sort of sticks to that sort of storyline, if there was, like, a big storyline. You know?
Yeah, it's actually very close. The main difference between Castlevania 3 in terms of its plot and what we see in Netflix is Belmont Clan is not excommunicated as such, but he is summoned by the church to try and rectify an invasion of monsters across Europe in general in the story of the game, whereby that's been tweaked ever so slightly for Netflix. And of course, he's been excommunicated, so he has no presence or relationship with the church, and he's not really welcome anywhere. Everyone's very superstitious of him. And the church plays a much bigger part in the Netflix series than it ever really did in any of the games. You were very much front and center battling monsters and Dracula, whereas you have this sort of split down the middle relationship in the Netflix series where Dracula and his horde and the church themselves are both also kind of equal in terms of the menace and the threat that they pose to the public at large. So I think it's very loyal to the source material, but it's taken a sort of artistic twist on it and done a really good job of making it more suitable for a TV program. And I've really enjoyed watching it. And as we said, Ben, we were just chatting before we started recording, I've watched the series many times, and you start to spot little things the more you watch it, things that make it little homages to the game and little touches that they made. It makes it really satisfying as a Castlevania fan and a gamer that there's definitely a lot of love poured into the production of this TV show. So I really can't wait for the second series, and this is going to be a fun episode to talk about, I think.
And definitely. Now, I probably asked John this as well, but I'm kind of glad, Matt, that this was actually like an anime manga style sort of, as opposed to an action sort of like with real life people, because I don't think it would have worked. I think it works really well with this sort of like animation.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the best thing that they did, particularly when they recruited Warren Ellis to sort of produce it and write it, is he, as I understand, is a very has a long history of writing very graphic comic books. And they haven't shirked on any of the violent or adult content in this. I guess you could say Castlevania very loosely. Even back in the 8-bit days, it isn't really aimed at children, although there wasn't enough in it to really put children off from playing it.
Yeah.
It, you know, you're dealing with armies of the dead and someone getting over the death of their wife and cursing humanity. It's all very adult subject matter. So they've remained faithful to that in the series. I was quite shocked at the amount of blood and gore that occurs throughout the series in general. I think that works really well.
Yeah.
This is definitely not a show for children. And I'm not a parent, but if I was, I don't think I'd be the most prude of parents. Mm. You know, I would let my children watch certain things that perhaps they shouldn't watch as far as certification is concerned, but I certainly wouldn't want them watching Castlevania. But I appreciate it more as adult entertainment, that it doesn't treat us like idiots. We know in this day and age, particularly from other things that have been on TV lately, that this kind of violence is almost expected for the period of time that this Castlevania series is covering, stuff like Game of Thrones and whatnot, is showing the world to be barbaric and brutal and doesn't dress it up like a period drama or anything silly like that.
Yeah.
This is real life as it was in a time where brutality was the norm and people abused their power on a daily basis, particularly in the name of religion, which is one of the key points of the series. So yeah, I absolutely love the direction it's gone in, and making it a truly 18 rated adult manga works great for me.
Yeah, I completely, totally agree. So I'll tell you what, let's go into episode 3, which is titled Labyrinth. Now, again, I'm watching these just like on the day, pretty much, more or less, so that way I've got a fresh perspective on it. Why don't you just tell us a little bit then about how this episode starts, and then we'll go on our chronological order.
Yeah, so if we just pick up from where it left off at the end of episode 2, Trevor has taken up the mission issued to him by the elder of the speakers to try and find his grandchild, who has gone missing in the catacombs under the castle, looking for the sleeping warrior. So that's how the episode starts. We join Trevor as he's trying to enter the catacombs and try and find out where the missing speaker has gotten to, and finds himself in a building that is more familiar than it perhaps should be because of certain features that Trevor has been told about by his ancestors. But we sort of come onto that a little bit later as to precisely what that is. But he's not been there before, but kind of recognises what he's seen and is very has a degree of trepidation as he's progressing through the catacombs, and then very quickly encounters an adversary.
Now, what I want to say about this is when it started to feel like the game to me, Matt, because as he starts walking down the stairs crumble, and that sort of like happens in some of the Castlevania games, and he ends up in this like weird sort of room, and it feels like a boss battle in a way, the way that the creature enters view, you know? Do you not agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that we as hardcore retro gamers have encountered many a times is crumbling platforms that you have to deal with. And there's a nice little bit of humour in there. He drops down the first platform, it crumbles underneath his feet, and he lands and he's like, reflexes like a cat, and then falls again, flat on his arse. And then we are presented with a Cyclops, which is one of the bosses from Castlevania Dracula's Curse.
Yeah.
So it's definitely paying homage to the game in a really good way there. It does make me wonder how much more of the game is going to actually go into the story later on. But great battle with the Cyclops. Trevor displaying some of his great combat skills in this particular instance to try and avoid being frozen by the Cyclops, as he's seen the statue of the speaker.
Yeah.
Which again is another nod to the game, because I can't remember which Castlevania game it is, but it might be Rondo of Blood, whereby Richter enters a room and he actually sees statues of the three heroes from, or four heroes, I beg your pardon, from Dracula's Curse.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that, so I've never got that far in Rondo of Blood, actually.
Yeah, I think it's Rondo of Blood. I hope I'm not just making that up. So it's kind of a homage, again, to precisely what happens in Dracula's Curse, the game, and then what sort of wider throughout the series. And we find out that the frozen statue is, of course, Cypher, who's a very important character in this series and in the game.
No, I mean, I thought it was fantastic, like what you're just describing there, when he's fighting against the sort of like the Cyclops, and first of all he throws his sword, stabs it in the chest, and realizes that's not the weak spot. And that's what made me think, just like a typical game, you have to hit that sort of weak point, like most boss battles do in games, and he gets it in the eye, and that's where he destroys it, and you know, like the statue comes to life, which becomes that character that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that they have the obvious weak spot in there, although I'm pretty sure we've never done a spinning drop kick of a dagger into the eye of a Cyclops in any Castlevania game, but yeah, it works well on TV.
Yeah, so what happens from there then, Matt?
Okay, so Trevor kills a Cyclops, and that reanimates the statue of Cypher.
Yeah.
And Trevor and Cypher then engage in conversation regarding why she's down there, while Trevor's been sent to rescue her or return her remains, as he thought he was going to do, because everyone presumed she was dead.
Yeah.
And he's actually quite shocked at that point that she is a she rather than a he. It was never pointed out to Trevor that he was rescuing a girl.
Yeah.
And apparently the speakers do this. They dress their women up like men to keep them safe when they're travelling. But again, this is another nod to the game of Dracula's Curse, because Cypher is a semi-playable character, and that's one of your companions in the game. And she's hooded in a robe like you see here at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
And it's never made entirely clear that it's a girl right up until the end, when she removes her hood and she's got long hair, and then it becomes very clear that it's a woman.
Spoiler alert, you just ruined Castlevania 3
for me. If you haven't played it by now, you're probably not going to be able to do it right. So.
About 20 years too late with spoiler.
So the two, they're conversing about the purpose of being down there. Trevor convinces her that she needs to leave and stop searching for the Sleeping Warrior, as it's more than likely just a trap to lure people down there to the Cyclops, and that he needs to return her to the surface and deliver her to her grandfather, so they will leave the city as they agreed in the second episode.
Now, I think, where does it go from there, though? So, like, Trevor sort of gets run into some sort of, like, these priests who take him to the bishop, and the bishop basically says to him, it's like, you've got to turn over the speakers to us and stuff like that, and he sort of declines that offer. He's not keen on doing it. I want to ask you something. What's your view on Trevor? Because at first I didn't like him, but I'm liking him in this. He's not like your typical hero, you know. He's got some unlikable qualities, but there is a charm about him that I actually do like.
Yeah, he's very much an anti-hero, isn't he?
Yeah.
He starts off kind of resenting humanity because of what they've done to his family and their part in the excommunication of the Belmont clan. But as he sees their suffering in general, he warms to the fact that he needs to help these people, as particularly when he encounters the speakers and how they're being persecuted by the church and the townsfolk of Gretschit, which is the city that they're located in at this point. So Trevor returns Cypher to the surface. He then goes wandering and bumps into the clergyman who he's had a scuffle with in the previous episode, where he whips the guy's finger off, which was a classic scene, probably the best in the series. Nice. It was really, really cool. And of course, the guy whose eye he whipped out, which
I was surprised
incredible.
That he was still standing. I mean, like, I thought you'd be like in a bed somewhere. I didn't think you'd still sort of like be, I don't know. Well, if that was me, I'll just be feeling sorry for myself. Wow.
I guess there's no sick pay in this particular period of history, mate. So the guy's just got to carry on preaching. So
carry on preaching.
Yeah, they take Trevor, deliver him to the Bishop of Gresham, who, of course, was the guy who arranged the sacrifice or the burning at the stake of Dracula's wife, Lisa. And this is a really cool piece of dialogue between the two. And again, Trevor shows his absolute disdain for the church.
Yeah.
Tells the bishop that it's tough shit. And he says, you're not supposed to be asking me questions. I'm supposed to be asking you questions. But Trevor's got no respect for the church whatsoever. And he won't bow down to their demands like the rest of the townsfolk do. And he's really questioning the bishop's logic and his rationale for the things he's doing, why he killed Dracula's wife. So it's a really good scene, this. And this is where Castlevania for me really succeeds, because it's all well and good that it has these pieces of action and lots of gore and violence. But I think that the dialogue at times is a little bit cheesy in points. But when it gets it right, like this particular scene where you can really get into the mind of the bishop, who's clearly mad on power.
Yeah, yeah.
And he genuinely thinks he's delivering God's work, whereas in reality, he's just using religion as a means to quash the people into doing his will. Mm-hmm. And then you have Trevor, who's kind of a bit too clever for most people of this period of time. He understands how the world works and that religion is not nearly as important as these people make it out to be, and that there are bigger concerns to be worried about. And it's only through the church's doing that there's evil being brought on the land, and he's trying to make the bishop realize that the speakers have nothing to do with it. But of course, allowing the speakers to go unchecked would demean the power of the church. So the bishop's very keen to remove them or kill them, as it's more likely. And Trevor's made it very obvious that he's going to stand up for them at every point.
And he sort of does that in a way, because they come looking for the speakers, and when they enter that room, this is a few scenes later, they just find Trevor there, and Trevor sort of like gets confronted by these guys and they surround him, and he ends up getting into a bit of a tussle and then brings down that building behind them.
He does, and even before that happens, Trevor, he's left the church, this conversation with the bishop, he's gone back to the dwelling where the speakers are,
he's
kind of ordered them, like, we had a deal, you guys need to leave, and the speakers make it very clear, look, we're not running away from our problems like you did when your family was excommunicated. We don't run away from our truth when people lie about us. We stay and fight. You should leave now, Trevor Belmont. This is what Cypher says.
Yeah.
And she hasn't gained the respect for Trevor yet that the rest of them have. She's quite prepared to stand up for him when he's being a little bit rude.
Yeah, yeah.
But then Trevor, he kind of sighs under his breath. Oh, God, how am I going to actually convince these people? And then he says, no, you are leaving right now. And we don't see him actually do this, but he actually delivers them to the catacombs to keep him safe.
Yes.
Whilst he waits for the churchmen to arrive, try and take the speakers, but he springs an ambush on them of sorts.
Yeah, and that caught me by surprise, because I wasn't expecting them to do that. And we'll cut this bit a little bit short, but I mean, he sort of like ends up going outside, and then we start seeing sort of like all the demons and everything approaching the village from the sky. They're flying in. Then you've got like this scene with all these sort of villagers with sort of like torches and whatever else. And it just suddenly ends. And I'm thinking, wow, they've got so much story in 20 minutes. And this is what I love about this, that they do that really well. They manage to fit in all the storylines.
Yeah, they do manage to pack quite a lot of dialogue and plot movement into such a short period of time. Based on how the episodes are kind of divided, I don't think of them as four different episodes. I think of it as like an hour and 20-minute movie that's just divided into chapters, because you can watch the whole thing and you wouldn't notice an enormous amount of passage of time. It's not like watching a weekly TV series where you watch one thing and it kind of covers like one or two days, and then there's a period of time in between, and then you go on to the next episode. It's not like this is all almost like real time. It's kind of like watching 24.
Yeah.
How the whole thing was condensed into a short period of time. And there isn't a whole lot of passage of time in this series other than at the beginning. when Dracula dies, and you skip forward a year when he brings his reign of terror onto the Wallachians. But everything after that is very condensed. It's Trevor traveling from place to place. He's meeting new people. He's getting into skirmishes. So they really pack a lot into those 20 minutes. And even when there's not fighting going on, there's still plenty of good dialogue.
Right. I mean, I've really enjoyed all three episodes. I mean, so far, I've enjoyed episode one the best because I love Dracula. I loved Lisa. I love the way they interact. I thought it was brilliant. Episode two, I thought, was a little bit slower. This felt more action-packed. I really enjoyed it. And it's got me thinking, I really hope episode four, which is the last one of season one, ends with a big bang. Don't give anything too away. Is that a good episode?
Oh, yeah, it is. And it definitely leaves you wanting more, but you're going to see addition of a new character who most Castlevania players will recognise. Some great more action and some really good skirmishes between Belmont and friends and monsters and against the church. It really wraps up the first series in a really good way.
Oh, fantastic. So I can't wait to watch the next episode, which will be episode four. Hopefully, Matt, I'm putting you on the spot here. Hopefully you can join us next week. John let us down this time because he's probably in a bar Trevor Belmont drunk somewhere. But hopefully he would have sobered up by next week. And
he's not fucking goats, then I think we're okay.
I wouldn't put that past him, mate. I wouldn't put it past him. But yeah, so why don't you tell people then, Matt, where people can find you?
Yeah, sure. So I spend most of my free time and podcast land working on the RGDS podcast, which, of course, you got me involved with, Andy, thank you very much for that. We've done some really cool episodes lately. We put out a really good show on the Mass System most recently, which is doing really well. People seem to be really enjoying it. So do check us out there. I'm sure if people listen to this, they probably already listen to RGDS, but just in case.
Yeah.
And again, if you want to see or read my written piece about the Netflix series of Castlevania, head over to failcritics.com. You'll be able to find that quite easily as well.
Oh, lovely jubbly. And people can find you on Twitter at LamboMatt, I believe.
That's right. Come say hello.
Yeah, definitely. So the next thing I want to ask you, now normally when I've been around in these episodes, I've been editing in some music from one of the Castlevania games. Episode 1, I added music from Aria of Sorrow. Episode 2, some music from Symphony of the Night. What track and what game would you like me to end the show with?
Wow. I think I know which one I'd like to go for. There's so much to choose from.
Oh, it is.
Okay, I'm going to go for one slightly out of left field, but seeing as we're dealing with this particular series and it's based on Castlevania III, I would like you to play the Famicom version of Castlevania III's track called Beginning.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Now, the reason why we're going for the Famicom version is because, as opposed to the NES version, the Famicom version of the game came with an extra sound chip in the cartridge, which makes the sound quality have much more rich synthesis. You'll be able to tell the difference if you listen to one.
Not know that about the Famicom cartridge, like on Castlevania 3, having that. Yeah, wow.
Just on selected Konami games, but Castlevania 3, that on the Famicom sounds so much better than it does on the NES. So if you can play Beginning from that one, that would be awesome.
Consider it done, my friend. Thank you very much for joining me on the episode of Castlevania Podcast Companion Piece. This has been episode 3. I've been Andy Godoy, as always, and thanks very much, guys. See you all next time. Goodbye.
Speak to you later.